This is FinTech Takes, the podcast keeping you in the loop on all the latest FinTech trends, news, and ideas. I'm Alex Johnson, creator of the FinTech Takes newsletter, your host and self-confessed FinTech nerd. Let's go! Hello, and welcome back to FinTech Recap. My name is Alex Johnson, and I am joined, as always, by the most popular man in banking as a service, the publisher of FinTech Business Weekly, my friend and international man of mystery, Jason Mikula. Jason, how are you today?
I'm surviving, Alex. I've picked the worst time to come down with what I think is just like a cold. You know, I even went and got a rapid COVID test, which was negative. Mm-hmm. So I do not have COVID-24, but I'm trying to like use this as an excuse to nap as much as possible. So I'm like fully healed for the Vegas craziness that it will actually probably be in the rearview mirror by the time this episode airs. So this week, Alex and I are joined by a special guest, the ghost of FinTech Future, which I will use this opportunity to ask you to explain what that means, John Zanoff, founder of Empire FinTech and organizer of an amazing conference that takes place each year in New York, which Alex and I will also be attending in April. John, great to have you.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks so much, Jason and Alex.
What does being the ghost of FinTech Future entail exactly?
Yeah, so not a lot of folks know that I've been in banking and asset management for 15 years. I was a product manager before it was something that the non-technical co-founder had to do because they couldn't do anything else. Inventing, in the early days of E-Trade, inventing the product management function, it's very simply you had hundreds of thousands of requests or decades of man hours, man days of requests coming in from customers, and you couldn't possibly do it all. And so you had to decide what were you going to focus on? What were you going to divest? And I was at the time, the largest asset manager in the world running product. And that is product management, and this isn't talked about a lot, it's a very difficult role. You're just making enemies left and right. Your job is to say no more than it is to say yes, kind of like an investor. And one day I was in, and if you don't know much about the BlackRock culture, Sorry, I divulged the largest asset manager in the world. But if you don't know much about that culture, very buttoned up, you're talking suit and ties on Sundays. And I sort of lost my cool. And I told the team, who was just debating what the second versus third priority was, is the end of the day, a product manager's responsibility is just to make sure that everyone understands what the future of fintech is going to look like. And if we decide not to prioritize the future of fintech, I have no fucks. And I just wrote Ghost of FinTech Future on the whiteboard, dropped the marker, and I think I had a 50-50 shot of being fired that day. But it turned out that it just resonated with the team. They had a stronger appreciation of the role of product and the role of products deciding what you're going to invest in and what you're not going to. But at the end of the day, if somebody wants to say, you know what, this is strategic and that's not strategic, that's not our business. Our business is just to make sure the entire organization understands what the future is going to look like. So anyway, it was a whiteboard marker drop moment in which I easily could have been fired, and I have an amazing story and LinkedIn profile to prove it.
Well, fork in the road moment, and it's funny you describe sort of making enemies left and right and saying no all the time, because that's kind of what you do when you're putting this new conference together and New York FinTech Week, which we will get into a little bit later at the end of the show. But John, delighted to have you join Jason as we break down the next month or so. Last month or so in FinTech news. So
obviously we have to talk about the Capital One Discover deal. Jason, I know you have some thoughts, so why don't you get started?
So there's certainly a lot to unpack in thinking about this deal. A lot of the conversation, at least the conversation I saw sort of on LinkedIn, on Twitter, as well as in the sort of trade press, tech press, focused on the card network piece, both the synergies, which is my favorite business word, that could provide to Capital One in the course of this acquisition, as well as the perceived benefit to competition. And a piece of this that I'm embarrassed to admit I did not know prior to this deal is that the Durbin Amendment capping debit interchange only applies to four-party networks, meaning Visa and MasterCard, and does not apply to three-party networks, which is Discover and American Express. So on the one hand, there is a, I think, valid but not without caveats argument that by acquiring Discover, and specifically Discover's network, and moving Capital One's existing debit cards to the Discover network, it is increasing the legitimacy of Discover as a competitor to the duopoly of Visa and MasterCard. However, and maybe this is like my own ignorance or lack of sophistication in the payments landscape, I don't immediately understand how that tailwind to Discover as a network results in pricing decreases from Visa or MasterCard. Like, there may be an argument there that I'm not aware of or don't understand, although some people in the space who are more sophisticated than I am have argued that increased competition between networks can actually drive prices up as the networks provide various kinds of incentives and rebates to issuers and to merchants. So at least at this point, I wouldn't necessarily take it at face value that any sort of perceived increase in competition necessarily equates to a reduction in interchange or to merchant discount rate that merchants are going to pay to accept cards. And as we're all probably aware of and don't need to rehash, even if the increased competition resulted in those cost to merchants falling, there's more than adequate research that suggests those savings are absolutely not passed along to consumers. I'm sure I could ramble on about more of these issues, but I want to hear what John thinks. John, Capital One, Discover, what is your hot take?
I appreciate that, Jason, but really quick, do you like the deal? Do you not like the deal? This is binary.
It's a yes or no.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know how to answer that question.
So that's a no. That's a no, Alex.
Put it down for a no.
I like the deal. Yes, I'm a yes. Wait, hold on. If I were a Capital One shareholder, which I assume I am through some ETF somewhere, then the answer is yes. Do I think it's a good deal for Capital One if it goes through? Absolutely.
I love it. I mean, that's actually, that would be the right rebuttal or the follow-up question of like, who do I represent? Do I represent innovation? Do I represent the consumer? Capital One shareholders? That's great. I freaking love the deal. But first, we're like 10 or 15 minutes in. So it's important to note, I know like my friends at SVB listen to this podcast while they're running in the morning. So if that's you, you should be settling into race pace right now. If you're listening to it in the evening, Jason said Durbin and he said synergy. That means two shots if you're listening to this podcast in the evening. The other question though, you know, so one, I like the deal and I'll tell you why I like the deal. But two, the question no one's asking is, what is going to happen with the empty Discover booth that you're confronted with when you walk onto the exhibit floor every year at Money 2020? I mean, it's such a nice facility for you to take a nap because nothing's ever happening in that booth. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's, you know, top priority in terms of questions we should be asking. Give you a serious answer. You know, M&A, the world of media loves M&A. Everyone loves to talk about an acquisition, a deal, a liquidity event. But what does it mean for innovation? 99 out of 100 times when we're talking M&A in the fintech world, it's bad for consumers and it's bad for innovation. It is premature. There are markets that are not mature. And so consolidation will remove the pricing dynamics that can spur competition and basically consumers lose. Look at, let's say, I don't know, Plaid Quobo as my favorite example. In this case, yep, Jason's eyes said it. John went to shade within 15 minutes of this podcast. But at the end of the day, Discover is 40 years of technical debt. Discover can't innovate their way out of a paper bag, not because they don't have some of the best engineers on the planet, because they have 40 years of technical debt. That means they couldn't integrate interesting new fintech technologies. That means they couldn't launch new interesting pricing schemes. And so it is the perfect epitome of a mature market, which glass half empty means 40 years of technical debt. Cap One, the perfect acquirer, having just gone through a major agile renovation top to bottom of their entire stack. Probably one of the few card issuers that aren't running on mainnets now. And I just love this. I love this for consumers. I love this for innovation. I love this for, you know, the Cap One Ventures team. I love it for pricing control versus the other networks. I think this is just a win-win across the board. And, you know, the other thing as we're sort of opining on this is everyone is talking about the CEO's comments on the call. And perhaps needless to say, but when you're that level of media trained, that level of media training means we have no idea what their plan is. Media training is you get asked a question and you don't answer it. You answer the question you want to, and the audience is none the wiser. That's great media training. So what are they going to do with the Pulse Network? What are they going to do expanding globally? Are they going to keep the Discover It brand? Are they going to keep 24/7 customer support in between the coasts in the US? We have no earthly idea, but what I can opine on is I think this will be fantastic for consumers and anyway, and any company that builds up 40 years of technical debt because they failed to fire their architects over the years. This is just great news for consumers.
Well, and Zanoff, the other thing you didn't mention in addition to the 40 years of technical debt is Discover in the last, year or two has sort of turned into like a Wells Fargo-esque comedy act in terms of stepping on rakes on compliance issues and getting hit in the face. And I do think from a timing perspective, that was a big part of it too. And I, you know, we haven't really talked about, and this is like, you know, the best, like just random speculation because none of us know what the hell we're talking about. But the question of, is it going to get approved or not is a really like juicy question to kind of like, you know, toss out takes on because, you know, I do think there is one way of looking at this, and there have been plenty of legislators who've come out and said this is going to be bad for competition, this shouldn't be allowed to go through. If only they had some mechanism to like make their will known in some way, rather than just writing press releases and tweets, I don't know what that would look like exactly. But I think that, you know, the fact that Capital One's not stupid, right? And to your point about Richard Fairbanks and being like, well, media trained, like that's a very well-run shop. They know what they're doing. I'm sure they've gamed out all the different scenarios for getting this acquisition approved. And I would imagine that part of that gaming out is Discover had gotten itself into a decent amount of trouble with regulators on just sort of basic sort of blocking and tackling for some of the things they should have been doing. And this would potentially be a way to solve that headache if you're someone like the OCC. So I think that's definitely part of it. You know, Jason, the thing I didn't know until I was reading all the coverage of this, and I think it was actually a quote from the CEO when he was talking about this, was this actually doesn't directly go to the Department of Justice or any of the other sort of regulators that are in charge of sort of antitrust matters. This is one that goes to Capital One's prudential regulator, and then they essentially loop in the Department of Justice to sort of add their opinion on top of it. And so I'll be very curious to see just from an antitrust perspective, like, is this seen as, yeah, to your point, bad for consumers, good for consumers, roughly just a reshuffling of the status quo? I don't know.
Well, Anne, you mentioned the third rail of antitrust, but we also need to remember that that's not the only consideration in approving this deal. I certainly cannot take credit for this, but Michelle Alt, former OCC regulator of Claros Group, put together a very helpful chart, which is probably not helpful because this is a podcast, sort of comparing
audio medium, Jason.
comparing what we know about the Capital One Discover acquisition with the OCC's guidance on what is consistent with approval under the Bank Merger Act. And by no means is this an open and shut case, right?
Yeah.
And bank regulators are not inherently, or they're not first and foremost, antitrust regulators. That, you know, that is perhaps a consideration, certainly not the only consideration. So, I mean, in addition to Discover's outstanding public enforcement actions, which could be a roadblock to an acquisition, although that business unit, the student lending business unit, they have said would be divested or put up for sale, you know, there are other potential problems in, you know, from a Bank Merger Act perspective, including just the sheer size. You know, and there's been clear messaging from bank regulators, including the OCC, you know, that they don't want to see already giant banks, which Capital One is, become even bigger, as well as, you know, perceived threats to competition. So we talked about pro-competition, well, maybe, on the network side, but the shift in Capital One's debit cards to, people have been using the phrase Durbin exempt, which, I mean, Durbin just doesn't apply to street party networks.
Right.
That could be perceived as a sort of anti-competitive or a public policy problem. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, consumer groups are going to weigh in on CRA issues, so Community Reinvestment Act, and consumer compliance stuff. So the general sentiment, and this is highly unscientific, but the general sort of Twitter sentiment seemed to be like, oh yeah, this deal is going to go through. And I was like, really? Like, it seems like a pretty easy, I mean, it's always going to be a punching bag for politicians on the left. You know, Elizabeth Warren put out her statement.
Well, there's some politicians on the right who came out against it too. Wasn't Hawley one of them who was like, we can't let this happen? You're like, oh, you should talk to Elizabeth Warren. You guys would get along great.
Yeah, I mean,
it's an election. Trump, they're going to turn it into whatever they want to turn it into.
He referred to it as, Josh Hawley, a Republican senator from Missouri, referred to it as destructive corporate consolidation at its starkest. And that if consummated, this merger will create a new juggernaut with unprecedented powers to extort American consumers. That cannot be allowed to happen.
That was written by ChatGPT. It's like, please, you know, write the most ludicrous, make me sound smart, write the most ludicrous argument against this.
So, I mean, I don't think by any means it is, you know, a done deal or a slam dunk. Although, Alex, to your point, it's not like Capital One and Discover don't both have sophisticated government relations people and lobbyists and close relationships with their regulators with whom I'm sure they had conversations prior to proceeding through acquisition negotiations. So we'll see how this unfolds over the rest of the year. But should we hop over to a little tropical destination?
Yes, we should. I'm not going to hum the song because I feel like that is inappropriate given that it's getting a little dark and scary on Bass Island. But for frequent listeners, we will be making a return trip. To John's earlier point, if you do listen to this podcast as a drinking game, here's another really good opportunity for you. Jason, give us the latest from Bass Island, please.
I mean, to extend this metaphor to very painful levels, I forget if I used this last time, but like Bass Island is definitely descending into a Lord of the Flies situation.
Yeah.
Joking aside, so I mean, I think, you know, people who've been following these topics closely were probably not terribly surprised that Lineage, a small bank based in Tennessee, received and entered into a consent order with its primary regulator, the FDIC, entered into the order in late January, became public towards the end of February. It is a rather lengthy order, and I'm not going to summarize all of it, but I will touch on a couple of areas. So, I mean, themes, you know, recurring themes in this segment as far as sort of what led to the order. So, due diligence failures, third-party risk management failures, particularly around BSA and AML compliance. You know, it should be noted that Lineage has worked with two BaaS platforms that I'm aware of, Synapse and Synctera, as well as having a handful of direct fintech relationships. There are a couple of elements I think are worth pulling out that stood out to me that I don't think were present necessarily in previous orders for BaaS banks. You know, there's a very strong emphasis on board, you know, board level involvement and awareness in BaaS programs, including like relatively specific metrics. So the order mentioned like FBO activity and transaction activity should be something that is surfaced to the board. I think it mentioned at like a monthly cadence. The risks of third-party ACH processing. So for folks who are not familiar with sort of what this is, it's the idea that a bank would be processing payment transactions that could be, in this case, ACH, but also wires, on behalf of customers or programs that are not actually clients of the bank. And it's important to note this because it connotes a different level of risk, which, if you're going to enter that business line, surprise, you need to have adequate policies, procedures, and controls in place to mitigate those risks. You know, Lineage had its capital requirements increased, which Blue Ridge also faced in its consent order. So it now must maintain 12.5% Tier 1 leverage ratio and a 16% total risk-based capital ratio. But in addition, and I don't think this has been present in other orders, there's basically a growth cap of a max of 10% annual growth without prior sign-off from FDIC in Lineage's assets or, you know, and or liabilities, as well as a slew of requirements around identifying and mitigating concentration risks, but like specifically deposit concentration risk from fintechs that I don't recall being part of prior orders. So we are seeing some sort of novel patterns and repercussions specifically from the kinds of activities Lineage engaged in. And this wasn't spelled out. This wasn't specified in the order. You know, sources tell me that Lineage is exiting the BaaS space. However, that will be contingent for the order on the FDIC signing off on plans to wind down those relationships. So basically, I read that as the regulator is concerned about Lineage and by extension, its BaaS partners' ability to exit these relationships in a manner that is safe and sound. That was a lot. Two very quick late-breaking news stories from BaaS Island. Green Dot, which sometimes people forget is a player in the BaaS space. It partners Apple Cash, works with Amazon, has a long history doing white-label prepaid cards with Walmart. According to its quarterly earnings that recently filed, disclosed a pending consent order with its regulator, and BaaS platform Treasury Prime, sources tell me, have laid off about half its workforce amid a strategy pivot. So that is a smorgasbord of topics. Alex, what in there do you want to respond to?
Oh, gosh. There's a ton to respond to. I mean, I think on the Lineage front, to your earlier point, not surprising that this would be sort of the outcome. I think you were actually the one who did some reporting early on about Lineage. If I remember right, you were trying to find someone in the state of Tennessee to file some requests to get access to some information. So, I mean, you've been on Lineage for a while. You didn't mention our favorite bank nerd, Kia Hazlitt's favorite term, brokered deposits, but there's a whole, I guess, sort of aspect to the Lineage deal, which you did touch on, which is like really fast growth in deposits and these sort of attendant risks that are downstream of that, right? And I think one thing that BaaS has sort of been catching up to in regards to other areas of safety and soundness regulation is, you know, regulators have known for a long time, if you grow deposits really quickly, that's usually a bad sign, right? Because what are you going to do with those deposits? What are you paying for those deposits? How stable are those deposits? Are you going to go crazy and do weird things lending money with those deposits? So the general profile of a bank that's growing its deposit base quickly, particularly through novel means, which is sort of broadly what brokered deposits has come to refer to, that tends to be a big warning sign. And so even though some of the things the FDIC is doing in response through this consent order are a little bit novel relative to other consent orders we've seen, it kind of didn't shock me based on what Lineage specifically has presented as a risk profile. And I guess I wouldn't be shocked if we see similar actions taken by the FDIC or other prudential regulators in response to some of these areas. I mean, Jason, just to put a quick number on it, they actually reclassified a lot of their deposits as brokered, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And to be honest, the only reason I noticed this is because I'd done some of the previous analysis that you mentioned, and I was going to check the numbers, you know, for something else in one of those call reports. And I was like, wait a minute, this number is not the number that was in here the last time I looked. And you know, you are able to refile or restate, you know, correct stuff in call reports. And at least based on what I was able to check against data I had pulled previously, restated from Q3 2022 until at least Q3 2023, basically for a year's worth of that, instead of having functionally zero broker deposits as originally reported, having somewhere in a range of 100 million to 125 million in broker deposits.
That's a much bigger number.
And for context, that was, you know, in certain quarters, as high as 50% of their deposit share.
That's a lot. That is a lot. Yeah, it all kind of goes to your point about, and I think Adam from Claros maybe was talking about this on LinkedIn, but I think a really interesting question that's emerging in the banking as a service space for banks that are involved in it is, how big should a banking as a service bank be? And how should we measure big, right? Should we measure it by assets? Should we measure it by number of employees? Should we measure it by, you know, the volume of transactions that they're processing, the number of third-party relationships that they have? I think a lot of prudential safety and soundness regulation is sort of oriented around asset size. So like the bigger you get in assets, the sort of more risky you are from a safety and soundness and systemic perspective, and therefore the more regulatory scrutiny you get. But banking as a service has created this weird sort of off-ramp for banks where they can really grow from a revenue perspective, a profitability perspective, the number of like third-party relationships they have, but they can facilitate those activities in such a way where their actual asset size doesn't change that much and they can stay under $10 billion or they can stay pretty small, but their profile from a risk perspective really starts to change. And so I do kind of sense with this lineage action that maybe prudential regulators are sort of wrapping their heads around what other types of profiles or characteristics should we be looking at from a risk perspective besides just growth and assets, which is kind of the traditional way that they do it. John, let's go to you. Of all Jason's many reports from Bass Island, any other ones jump out to you there?
Yeah, I mean, Alex, yeah, I think you asked the right question, which is how do we measure risk? And, you know, the reason that that's the right question and also an impossible question is that it's extremely dynamic based on new technologies, how you would measure the number of deposits or assets or number of customers. All of those you may have answered differently 10 years ago, sort of pre the venture community piling $1 billion too many dollars into Bass platforms. But I'm mixed on this story. I mean, I don't have a strong opinion. What I would say is from a competition, some of these regulations are just for competition and some are to protect consumers. And unfortunately, in this particular case, they're going against each other. Bass platforms have the ability to bring new technologies to market faster than ever before, offering consumers choice, but also competitive pressures and driving costs down. And they're also introducing, you know, additional risk to the banking system that we've never had before as these, you know, podunk Memphis banks all of a sudden have 400 million, you know, catwalkers with digital banking apps on their phone. And so it's an all new world. I mean, my fear in Bass Island is that we have not truly proven or disproven if this is an opportunity for how the world will move forward. Because there have been some bad actors and too much venture capital, the general sentiment is core providers and Bass platforms have simply been disproven as viable businesses. And I actually don't believe that whatsoever. Very excited to see new, interesting neobanks come up. Maybe not for every single affinity like Catwalkers in Memphis, but there's certainly room. And unfortunately, the sentiment right now is just, oh, everything's not fintech and this isn't, which I agree with, but this model doesn't work. It's about to be overregulated. And unfortunately, that's going to lead to fewer choices for consumers and higher prices for consumers. So I don't have any good answers other than to say my fear is this is going to be a detriment to innovation in the next 10 years.
Well, I mean, I absolutely think you're correct that it is a bit premature to conclude that the sort of business model, economic model of Bass writ large is not workable. You know, I think, you know, increasingly there are more and more questions about, you know, does it make sense to have a standalone middleware business or Bass platform business? You know, I think sort of the general sentiment on that has become more bearish. I mean, I think one of the pieces that makes this really hard to sort of parse and analyze is exactly what you said, John, about the excessive amount of VC dollars that have flooded into the entire ecosystem, not just Bass, but sort of broadly fintech. I mean, I have started thinking about this as like supply and demand, and you had all of these sort of consumer and SMB fintechs that were like, oh, we need bank partner, we need banking services. That was a function of VC money going into the space. And, you know, banks and by extension, middleware providers responded rationally by increasing supply. More banks are like, oh, ooh, this is an interesting line of business. I can source deposits. I can source fee income. And so they responded to the market signal, bringing more supply of BaaS, you know, onto the market. Obviously, that doesn't address all of the sort of challenges and compliance questions that have gotten us to the, you know, the problem we're in today. But now the question I have is, as that VC flood of money has receded and, you know, with the various forces, you know, shaping the supply side, you know, what banks are willing to play, what programs they're willing to play with, it's going to be interesting to see where that new equilibrium sort of comes out to continue torture in this metaphor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think to your point, Jason, I mean, I totally agree about the supply and demand way of looking at the market. And just to use like Treasury Prime as an example, and, you know, I feel for the folks who are impacted by this, that Treasury Prime, I've always thought of Treasury Prime as a really like good actor in the space who's been trying to do this the right way and, you know, doesn't take shortcuts. But a big part of their model, which in previous writings have referred to as the Hinge dating app model, is, you know, we're going to act as that sort of market maker and matchmaker where we're going to connect fintech companies that are looking for a bank partner with a bank. And like, we're going to sort of sit in the middle of doing that. But the reason I referred to them as the Hinge banking app was that Hinge's whole sort of marketing campaign is the dating app that's designed to be deleted, right? So eventually you find your partner through Hinge, you never need to go on another date again, you delete the app, and then you're off and you're married and you're happy. And so there is this kind of graduation problem, I think, that exists within banking as a service for those middleware providers where, you know, even if you do have a steady stream of new fintech startups coming up, and even if you do have a lot of banking partners that are looking to work with very early stage fintech companies, both of those assumptions, by the way, are not valid anymore the way they used to be. But even if you do have those, eventually the programs that you've helped put together, if they're successful, they get married and they go off and they kind of grow beyond your platform. And so I do think that, to your point, there are some very fundamental business model questions in the banking as a service middleware space in particular. I mean, I thought it was interesting that, you know, Treasury Prime was sort of positioning this as a pivot towards more of a bank focused model. And, you know, that's something else that I've noted in this space is it does seem like everyone who's in banking as a service from a technology platform perspective are all sort of realizing that they're core banking providers. Like they didn't know that they were, but that's actually kind of what they are. And, you know, they're starting to pivot into providing more services directly to banks, thinking of banks as their customers rather than fintechs as their customers, which is a bit of a mindset shift. And, you know, in some cases, we've seen some of these platforms get snapped up by some of the existing core providers. And so I do think that in a lot of ways, this BaaS middleware area is going to get not fully absorbed into the core banking space, but is going to sort of sit adjacent to that space and be seen more as a bank technology layer more than like a fintech enablement marketplace, which to your point is probably more of a ZERP era phenomenon.
That's exactly right. What's going to happen from here? We're going to be shifting to B2B technologies. And, you know, unfortunately, it's like the default move. Oh, consumer's been disproven. B2B is stickier. Venture dollars will go there. But I also think that the venture community and the startup community have a short-term memory, but it's still going to be, call it 5 years before serious dollars go into this. The move towards investing in bank technology, program management, that's been going on for some time. The bad news for those entrepreneurs is that's actually a pretty busy space in itself. With a company like Personetix that can provide unbelievable levels of intelligence into what your customers are doing, why, how much risk they represent to your bank already. So it's not exactly open field for the T-primes, bonds, Synapse units to go into that space.
We know that VCs have short-term memory because they gave Adam Neumann more money.
So it'll all come back around. Yeah.
It'll all come back around. Alex, do you want to take us to our last main story for the month?
Well, actually, Jason, I was thinking maybe we'd give Mr. Zanoff an opportunity to talk a little bit about New York FinTech.
Oh, yeah.
Since we are circling for a landing. But before we let you go, John, we want to have you give us the scoop. It's going to be the biggest and best New York FinTech Week ever, right?
We're pretty darn excited about it. It's April 8th through the 12th. And I'd say the biggest thing that folks, when they think of FinTech Week, because FinTech Weeks operate differently around the world, they don't realize that New York FinTech Week is open to everyone. It is, and this is maybe contested, the most inclusive fintech week on the planet. Anyone and everyone is encouraged to host an event. Empire, of course, started as the meetup in New York back in 2010. But since then, we think of ourselves as a platform. Our role is to bring the entire ecosystem together. So we're expecting over 50 events and 7,000 attendees in New York during New York FinTech Week, of course, including the best in the business, like the two of you. You also mentioned your favorite banker, Kia Hazlett, also now confirmed for the stage. So the TLDR is, mark your calendars, April 8th to the 12th. The big Cornerstone Conference is on April 10th, where just the best minds come together. Don't miss out on the boat cruise around the city kicking off the week. We've added a comedy night. Flourish Ventures is doing a health and wellness half-day event. It's truly bringing out the entire ecosystem to collaborate on this. And we just couldn't be more excited to have both of you attend, but of course, 6,000 of our other favorite fintech nerds in New York City in April.
Outstanding. I can't wait to come. It's one of my absolute favorite events. As you said, it is almost like a fintech festival happening in New York all week with all kinds of different events and after hours things. And there may be a basketball game happening. So stay tuned for details on that. Jason and I are both speaking. Unlike previous years, we will not be sharing the stage together, but we'll be doing different sessions. Jason, give us a little preview of what you're going to talk about.
I mean, very timely. I
will be spectacular.
Yes. Yeah.
I will be joining Nipa Patel, the founder CEO of Themis, which is a platform that helps banks, fintechs, middlewares collaborate to sort of better inventory, manage regulatory and compliance risks. And we're going to be giving a masterclass on how not to get in trouble.
So you'll have all
it's
the
answers. It's not the literal title. It's not.
No. Let's just like this is your solution to any banking as a service problems you have is just to come to Jason and Nipa's masterclass session.
Yeah,
did I summarize that right? Okay,
all
right, good.
Yes. I want to see a full room.
Yes. Well, I'm sure you will. I'll probably be across the hallway trying to beg people to come into my masterclass, but I'm actually very excited to be doing a similar type session. Mine is going to be focused on 1033, everybody's favorite four-number term in fintech. I actually have Jane Barrett, the chief customer officer at MX, who's fantastic, who I'm going to be peppering with all of my questions about not just 1033 and what's going to happen this year, but more importantly, what's going to happen in open banking after the rule is finalized and we have a new set of rules for the road for open banking and what the long-term implications of that will be. So can't wait to do that masterclass as well. And then all of the other sort of fun events and a comedy night. I'm so excited, John. This is going to be great.
I can't wait to have you guys. This is really, I don't like sports metaphors, but it is our Super Bowl. And I just can't wait to have both of you in New York City.
Jason, the Super Bowl is this like football game that they play kind of in like February, late January. People watch it. It's a big deal.
It's in yards.
So American football. I was
one of the many reasons I hate sports metaphors.
Oh, don't pretend like you're not from the Midwest. Come on now.
We were growing up, we were a Chicago Cubs family.
Okay.
And it was the early 90s. And of course, a Bulls family, because this was like the Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman, like the era of Chicago Bulls. I was going to say, John, where can people sort of see the full schedule of events? I know that I think people have to sort of sign up for stuff individually. So to make sure they know everything that's happening and get on any list they need to, where can they get that info?
Head over to empirestartups.com. And in fact, I want to test this readership, this listenership. And so you can use Bass Island, one word, Bass Island, for 15% off the conference.
All right. You heard it here. And we'll put that in the show notes as well. Bass Island gets you 15% off. You can't beat that. You can use it to pay your consent order.
We're definitely leaving that in. Jason, before we sign off, we need to do Can't Let It Go's really quickly. Would you like to go first or would you like me to go first?
I will go first and I will try to keep it brief.
Okay.
So I don't know if anyone remembers the financial app Zara, But we were kicking this around on Twitter, I think about a year ago.
Yeah.
Because it was just quite obviously a scam or a Ponzi scheme. It was promising fixed 3% monthly returns and claimed to be FDIC insured. I actually called the number on the site, and I'm pretty sure I talked to the guy running the Ponzi who told me, no, it's not Ponzi. And then I kind of forgot about it until I was reading Todd Phillips' paper, Stabilizing Fake Banks, which is really excellent, and I recommend reading it. And he mentioned, along with a bunch of other stuff, happened to mention Xera. And so I Googled it, and the SEC did, in fact, crack down on this company, which, yes, is a scam and Ponzi or Ponzi adjacent. The guy who was running it did use some of the $2.2 million he raised from 168 investors to buy horseshoes, saddles, and horse feed, as well as purchases at a tropical fish store, furniture, rent on his apartment, and car payments, as well as withdrawing $710,000 in cash. Like, I am not an AML expert, but how do you withdraw 700 grand in cash without raising any? Like, I hope they at least filed a SAR on this guy, because that's crazy. So, I mean, the wheels of justice turn slowly, but the company was shut down. Regulators did do their job, and that is what I can't let go of. Alex?
That's amazing. The tropical fish store, I think, detail is my favorite of all of that. There's something great about, you know, bilking people out of $2.2 million and spending it on tropical fish. That's just amazing. All right, mine is, well, it's, I suppose I could tenuously tie it to fintech, but I won't pretend. It's not really fintech related. Mine is tooth inflation. So my son, who is about to turn 6, is about to lose his first tooth, maybe his first couple teeth. They're coming out. And my wife and I are having a spirited debate over how much money the tooth fairy should leave him. In my day, you got $1, and it was always 4 quarters with a little bit of glitter on each one. I saw a Wall Street Journal headline that said, what's the tooth fairy leaving these days? $100 bills and Louis Vuitton bracelets, which made me want to just like abandon society and raise my kids in the woods. And then I also, upon doing a little bit more research, because I need data to go back to my wife with, apparently Delta Dental has actually been tracking how much money the tooth fairy leaves kids since 1998. And in 1998, it's amazing. This is like, I was like, oh my God, there's such great data on this. So apparently now it's about, what, $5.84 is the average. That is actually down from last year's all-time high of $6.23. And it is well up from $1.30, which is what it was when Delta Dental started tracking this in 1998. The other detail from the story that's just amazing is that the differences in different regions of the country are pretty big. So Jason, you're a Midwest kid. They get the lowest amount per tooth at $3.63.
They're losing the most, so you got to figure.
Well, yeah, exactly. The West Coast.
TAM is the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, TAM is the same, but like, you know, compare it to the West Coast, apparently that's the highest area. That's $8.54 per lost tooth, which is a 37% increase over last year's figure. Kids in the South drop down to $5.51. And in the Northeast, it increased by 12% to $6.87. So my question for both of you is, if you were in my shoes, what would be the tooth fairy return on a single tooth that you would recommend?
That's tough. I mean, I feel like when we were growing up, I can't remember if it was a dollar coin.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Or a $2 bill, but it was like a novelty. That's piece of novelty currency.
Yeah.
So it was like you didn't want to spend it because it was special, you know? Yeah.
Like a bear bond. Like I could just go like full like diehard and just give them one of those, right?
Yes. Yes. give them a bear bond under the pillow in like, yes, in issued by like Tooth Fairy. It's a Tooth Fairy debt instrument, I guess.
And then we can like start on a whole conversation about that. We can talk about that. I can show him Die Hard. Like, I'm liking this idea.
I mean, I feel like some kind of like stablecoin backed by like Tooth Fairy receivables, mm-hmm, is blockchain's the answer.
Blockchain.
Also, I don't have any kids And we did not give the dog Tooth Fairy money because there was just like no good, you know, he wasn't going to use it.
Right.
But I feel like John might have a good answer. Tooth inflation.
Thanks for putting me on the spot, Jason. I mean, I think from my comment on folks in the Midwest also losing adult teeth, I don't have anything amazing to add to this. I think that Zuckerberg is going to ruin your kids far before a $10 bill is going to ruin your kids. And so, you know what, Alex? Yeah. Spoil the heck out of them. They've got they have an awesome mom and awesome dad. They deserve the world, and can't wait to have them at New York FinTech Week in 10 years.
No, yeah. Well, I will definitely bring them along, but I'm also not going to let my wife listen to this podcast because I'm the one trying to hold this price down, guys, and you're the ones who are trying to raise it. So with that, we will go ahead and wrap it up. Jason, thank you as always. And John, awesome to have you on the podcast. We can't wait to see you in person in New York in April.
Looking forward to it.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FinTech Takes. Stay up to date with emerging companies and the latest FinTech trends by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love FinTech Takes, please tell a friend.